Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly's. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Oh,
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This, God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him, and then you felt like you wasn't worthy, and so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room, and I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me, and I said, I want you to do this graph for me, and that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Because I used to observe that a lot of those shacks used to be by the track where black people were.
With the room in the back.
Yes, with the room in the back. That was a safety net.
Yeah.
Where black people who would move here and there and go from here and there looking for jobs, that's usually why we moved. And the jobs would play out like they always did.
And do.
But we had a place to go when the sun went down. But now, those shacks by the track don't exist anymore. They came and built highways right alongside of those railroad tracks where those shacks used to be. Super highways. So now, if you get on a highway, you might notice that if you... Sometimes you are right alongside of a railroad track. You see trains passing
that
as you are driving.
That is true.
Down a superhighway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, those highways used not to be there in the northwestern hemisphere. It used to be shacks along there. A lot of those shacks were on what we call railroad property. But the railroad people, the people that ran the railroads, didn't care much because nobody wanted to be down. That wasn't prime real estate.
No.
Nobody wanted to be by the tracks anyway. So black people used to build those shacks around there back when black people knew how to build shacks. Black people don't know how to build anything now because they used to build places for white people, but they cut them off with things called unions, took the carpentry all out of the schools and all like that. So how many black people do you know that know how to fix anything now? It used to be thousands and millions of black people that know how to build a house from scratch out of old pieces of lumber.
Wow.
A lot of people don't remember that. Most people are not that old to have seen it done. I started coming along. I'm old enough to remember many black people used to get together on a Saturday afternoon. That was the only time they had off, or sometimes, or on a Sunday sometimes after church. They would get together, six or eight of them, and go down and build what they call a shotgun house. It wasn't much, but it was a roof over your head, a good solid roof. I've been in some of those houses, raised up in some, all right? They were excellent, solid houses. They could stand a lot of storm and rain. They weren't much, just maybe three rooms. But I've been in some of them, and there were many, 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 many of them. But along came the white supremacists and say, these Negroes know how to build stuff. We're going to fix that so the next generation won't know how to do anything except stand in front of a place that is built and big, because they won't know anything about carpentry or masonry or how to make anything with their.
At least one person who started off legally as a slave here in the United States and became an entrepreneur, and in quite a few cases, some became wealthy entrepreneurs. Not all, but it's a lot more than people are aware of, the concept of it, a lot of people are not even aware of the concept, but these people were aware, and there were plenty of them, so we feature at least one a day. So Slave Entrepreneur Month, we also featuring Black Towns History Month, where we from time to time this month of February 2022 give out a, let me make people aware of a township that was built by formerly enslaved people right here in the United States. We even give who were from the state of Mississippi, and they made a voyage over to Africa, particularly what is now known as the country of Liberia, and they built their own town there called Greenville, Liberia today, and that town's over 100 years old. So today, our title is C.R. Patterson and Sons, Slaves and Auto Entrepreneurs. That's who we'll be talking about today. If you got any comments or questions or whatever, 619-768-2945. We'll be back and give you the story on C.R. Patterson's and Sons, Slave and Auto Entrepreneurs.
I'll be as quick as I can, as quick as it takes to kill somebody, I guess. You want me to be that quick. But, you know, as Ms. Fletcher pointed out, and it doesn't take much to look on the local news every night and see how many black kids, black boys, black men are being killed with these stand-your-ground defenses that these people raise, and they get off. So I take issue with that. I'm the only person here of color.
I was talking to a cat the other night. He said, What everybody's looking for today? They're looking for escapism.
Clean, huh?
And on the seat.
Excuse me, cat, while I rap.
All right. Man, I was talking without that mic on. All right. We are featuring today C.R. Patterson & Sons, Slave and Auto Entrepreneurs. Let's get to it. Okay. C.R. Patterson & Sons. C.R. Patterson & Sons was an American automotive company active from 1893 to 1939. Okay. Primarily in Greenfield, Ohio, one of the and for 1 year in Galea, Ohio. The first African-American founded car company founded by Frederick Douglass Patterson and named after his father, Charles Rich or Richard Patterson, they made the Patterson Greenfield Automobile. All right. Let's go into a little history here. Precursor. Charles Rich Richard Patterson, 1833 to 1910, founded a precursor company or companies to C.R. Patterson and Sons. Patterson had been born in 1833, a slave on a Virginia plantation. There were other conflicting stories on how he left the plantation. He ended up living in Greenfield, Ohio, which was the site of the underground railroad station. Now, I'll say it before, I'll say it again. A lot of entrepreneurial ventures started by way of the Underground Railroad. Let's see. He initially worked at Dines and Simpson's Carriage and Coachmakers Company and learned blacksmithing. Charles, that gets into a lot of people who went from slave to entrepreneur, they did by becoming artisans, people who made things. Charles Patterson partnered with a local carriage builder, J.P. Lowe, a white man, and they created J.P. Lowe and Company in 1873. By 1888, the business employed 10 people, which was considered successful at the time. The United States was experiencing the Panic of 1893, a financial crisis, and business was suffering. As a result, in 1893, the company was renamed C.R. Patterson and Son, and the company, after Patterson bought Lowe's shares and to mark the inclusion of his son Samuel to the business. Samuel Patterson fell ill in 1897 and died in 1899. His eldest son, Frederick Douglass Patterson, moved home to help with the business. By 1900, the company was producing 28 different horse-drawn carriage styles, buggies, backboards, tins, which is a type of carriage, and surreys, which is another type of carriage, and popular by the doctor's buggy. They had 50 employees and were able to manufacture approximately 500 horse-drawn carriages a year. Manufacturing is where it's at, people. It's where it's at. They did this without robots, no computers, as we know them today. And many other things. Automobile manufacturing. After Charles Patterson's death in 1910, his son Frederick Douglass Patterson took over the carriage business and decided that they needed to get into the Patterson horseless carriage business. At first, they offered the service of repairing existing automobiles in a local area. On September 23, 1915, the first C.R. Patterson & Sons automobile was assembled, a two-door coupe. The first cars were sold for $685. You know what? I bet you back during this period of time, you didn't even need a driver's license to drive one of these things. But somehow local and state government finds a way to get into your pocket. And anyway, with additional reports of the car selling for $850 or $17,741 to $22,000. Wait a minute. Yeah. And adjusted with inflation for 2021. They also got into bus and truck manufacturing. In 1918, C.R. Patterson & Son halted their auto production and concentrated once again on the repair side of the business. By the 1920s, they started focusing on building and designing truck and bus bodies, which were lifted the chassis and made by other manufacturers. The company renamed Greenfield Bus Body Company. Frederick Douglass Patterson died 1932, and his son Postel Patterson, 1906 to 1981, took over the business. Most of the bus bodies were purchased by school boards in Southern Ohio, West Virginia, Kentucky, and as well as the Ohio Transit Company, used in Cincinnati and Cleveland. In 1938, the company was reorganized under the name of Galea Body Company, and the headquarters moved to Galea, Ohio. Unable to raise enough money, the company closed in 1939. All right, we're going to go to the phone lines here in 2 minutes. We got to take a quick break.
What? Like that.
Oh, no, you didn't.
It ain't like stepping on ants, Jake. Takes a man to kill. You man enough to kill, Jake? Hit me right there. Get me, Jack. Get me. Hit me. Hit me. You can't do it. Somebody drop this fool for me.
You got us twisted, homie. We gotta put your own work in around here.
It's like that, Bone?
It's like that.
Player to player, pimp to pimp. I'm believe you shoot me, nigga. Don't do it. Don't do it. Now I'm believe he got it in you, Jake. Shit. I'm gonna get that gun, and then I'm gonna get that money. And you ain't gonna do a damn thing, because you ain't gonna shoot no cop in the back, are you?
Don't do it.
You know what they give you for that? The gas chamber. You know what the gas chamber smells like? Pine oil. That's where you headed, boy. To pine oil heaven. I'm going to get that gun, and then I'm going to get that money. I don't believe you got it in you, Jake. I'm going to go get it right now.
Oh, shit! Ah, you motherfucker!
The next one will kill you.
Oh, son of a bitch! You shot me in the ass!
Okay, wait. Okay. All right, listen. Wait, Jake, I need the money. Give me the money, Jake. Give me the money, please, Jake.
Give me that money!
It's not gonna happen. Oh, you gonna jack me now? You gonna take my own money from me, huh?
I told you, that's my evidence. You wanna go to jail, you wanna go home.
I wanna go home, Jake. Come on.
Give me the money and let me go home.
Yeah, yeah. You want to go home?
Yeah, let me go home, Jake. Come on, give me the money and let me go home. Give me the money and let me go home. Let me go home, Jake. That's right. Come on, Jake. You don't deserve this.
Jake, go ahead and bounce, homie. Get up out of here. We got your back.
What?
Just like that.
Oh, no, you didn't. Wait a minute. No, you didn't. Hey, Jake! Hey! Jake! 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 Come back here! Jake! You disloyal, fool-ass, bitch-made punk. Jake! I need my money! Jake! Oh, you motherfuckers. Okay. All right. I'm putting cases on all you bitches. Huh? You think you can do this shit? Jake! You think you can do this to me? You motherfuckers will be playing basketball in Pelican Bay when I get finished with you. Shoe program, nigga. 23-hour lockdown. I'm the man up in this piece. You'll never see the light of day. Who the fuck you think you fucking with? I'm the police. I run shit here. You just live here. Yeah, that's right. You better walk away. Go and walk away, because I'm going to burn this motherfucker down. King Kong ain't got shit on me.
All right, today we're featuring C.R. Patterson and Sons, From Slave to Auto Entrepreneurs. Let's go to our phone lines here. 866, your mic is open.
Omar's coming.
And he was a rough one, too.
Oh yeah. But that cop is running a close second. I remember that cop. Okay? So the one thing that stood out to me is the first entrepreneur, or not the first one, but they were in the 1800s.
Right.
Were those companies formed and operated during times of slavery?
Let me get the dates here. All right. Let me read it as they have here. Let's see. All right. Charles Richard Patterson was born 1833. So he founded the company. What year did he, let's see. All right. Charles Patterson partnered with a local carriage builder, J.P. Lowe, a white man, and they created J.P. Lowe Company in 1873. So that was
okay.
10 years after slavery was abolished.
Okay.
But
he
legally started off life as a slave.
Okay, because I was going to say he obviously had to start business well before that 10 years. So
right.
I've said that free enterprise was free to everybody, even slaves were business owners. So,
well, we featured, let's see, so far like Junius George.
Yeah.
Let's go back to him because he was he started. Let me see if we can get the year he started his business. Junius George Grove. Well, you know what? I got a better one. But he didn't start off life. Well, let me go back. Well, since I'm thinking about it, Paul Cuffey. Now, he was around during colonial times, but I don't think he was never enslaved. Let's see. Okay, Paul Cuffey. He was born in Massachusetts, the youngest son of Kufi Slocum and wife. Both were Ashanti slaves. All right, Kufi, his dad, was an Ashanti slave of Akan heritage. The Ashanti form of slavery was different from American chattel slavery. In a number of ways, Ashanti slaves had legal rights, could own property, inherit property, and marry. Around 10 years old, Kufi was either seized or sold to the Fanta metal man. Now, what's interesting about this is, and Pianki brings this up, if you go to Paul Cuffey's background, his father, who was an African slave, they were slave trading. African slave tribes were trading amongst each other. All right, anyway, let's see.
They traded each other off.
Well, yeah. Let's see.
So we need to acknowledge our nation in slavery. Some of our people sold some of our peoples into slavery.
Right.
Just saying.
Let me go back to Junius.
The truth is the truth. It's not always sweet.
Right. Junius George Groves. Let's see. Junius George Groves. Now, he was born in 1859. So when he started up his business, slavery was abolished. Josiah Henson, the original Uncle Tom. Let's see, Josiah Henson. Okay. Now there are a lot of these people published what we know today as slave narratives, which we'll get into that one day. Let's see. All right. Josiah Henson, born 1789, sunset 1883. All right. Now, Josiah Henson was born on a farm near Port Tobacco, Charles County, Maryland, on a plantation by Francis Newman, where Henson experienced slave atrocities. Henson's father was enslaved by Francis Newman's, whereas Josiah Henson, his mother and siblings were enslaved by Josiah McPherson. When he was a boy, let me see when he escaped here. Escaped from slavery. All right, after convincing his wife to escape with him, Henson's wife created a knapsack large enough to carry both of their smaller children. The eldest two would accompany his wife. The Henson family, man, can you imagine that? You're escaping, and you're carrying two human bodies on you, living bodies. Anyway, they had to be in some excellent shape. The Henson family left Kentucky traveling through the night, sleeping in the woods. Hold it. Let's see. Slavery policy. And, all right, hold it. When did, all right, 1833. All right, by the time Henson arrived in Canada, they had made an upper Canadian home, including black loyalists in America from 1833. Slavery was outlawed in the British Empire. And by this time, Canadians were still part of the colonial British Canada. All right, so Josiah Henson, he escaped when slavery was still legal, found his way to Canada, and, all right, let me read this part. All right, Josiah Henson worked on farms near Fort Erie, then Waterloo, moving with friends to Colchester in 1834 to set up a black settlement on rented land. After earning enough, all right, so Josiah Henson, the original Uncle Tom, and it, we mean Uncle Tom in a positive way, because it, we'll have to go, you know, one day we just need to go through Uncle Tom's Cabin. Because Sambo was the real villain. When people call people Uncle Tom today, they really should be calling those people Sambos. But that's another podcast. Anyway, after earning enough money, Henson also was able to send his eldest son Tom to school, who in turn taught Josiah how to read. And that's a switch. The children teaching their parents how to read. Henson became literate. And you know what? We really need to take a word at this word, literate. Because although at first Josiah Henson was not reading and writing literate, the man had other literacy skills. To navigate that Underground Railroad, you know, you need to know something about, astronomy, you know, which direction you're going in at night, how to forage food, because they had to eat. There were no grocery stores 7-Elevens along the way.
So watch this. He may not have known how to read letters, words, scripture, right, escriture.
Right.
But he could read a map.
He can read the stars and how to navigate, yeah.
He could read a compass. He could use the stars. And so that ability is equal to the ability to read. Yes, it is. It needs to be acknowledged.
Now, let's take it a step further with his literacy.
He was not illiterate. It's more correct to say that he just was not in the reading of the English language. How about that?
Right, because he was definitely literate. Okay. The contacts and financial assistance was he was able to, through contacts, social capital, and financial assistance there, this is in Canada, he was able to purchase 200 acres of land in Don Township in neighboring Kent County to realize, let's see, his Britain, realize his vision of a self-sufficient community. Now, this is a man that didn't know how to read and write at one time. All right.
Right, and I heard you say that he formed a black community on rented
yeah.
land. That's a business.
That's true. Business literacy. Right. The Dawn Settlement, that's what it was called, reached a population of 500 people. At its height, exporting black walnut lumber to the United States, so they had a community-based business, lumberjacking. Okay. Exporting black walnut number, I mean black walnut lumber to the United States. Now, to go back to your question, if Josiah Henson decided to go back to the United States at this time, he would have been legally classified as a slave. Cuz he didn't manumit himself. He didn't negotiate with his slave master and purchase his freedom. He escaped. So he was a runaway slave at one. Matter of fact, had he come when he started this town in the United States, he was legally classified as a runaway slave. But in Canada, he was free. So let's see, Henson. Let's see, became active. The lumber also made its routes to Tennessee and Ontario, Canada. He also served in the Canadian Army as a military officer, having led a black militia. Now, once again, he had a number of different titles in Canada. However, in the United States, he was still classified legally as a slave. Let's see. Anyway, so he helped start a town on 200 acres, and then later on he got 200 more acres for himself and his family. It says Henson conducted several trips back to Kentucky to guide other slaves to freedom. So this man was very literate at the art and science of escaping, you know, how to go around, you know, during it, because he didn't get caught, Harriet Tubman didn't get caught or whatever. So, I guess slavery was a matter of, I guess a very literate decision is, okay, if I stay in this position, I'm a slave. However, if I can make it to another place geographically, I'm free. So I would call that a literate man.
Yeah.
See, he had the skills. Cause think about it. Back then, there was no interstate highway system like we know today. There was no state highway system as we know it today. There were no rest stops. With flush toilets, and you can buy yourself a coffee or a hot dog or some candy. None of that existed when he was doing this. All right. So he knew how to forage for food. You know, if we put you out, and he couldn't travel main roads back then. Because he would be on the rail. He couldn't travel on the grid as they knew it back then. So, you know, they had to, you know, because nature basically is a grocery store. You know, squirrels, birds of all kind, snake, I mean, everything you can think of in nature, in the animal kingdom, they're eating from what the universe or the nature has provided for them. Okay, so nature is a grocery store. However, modern man, the typical modern man, does not know how to recognize what foods that they can eat within nature that will nourish them and sustain them physically versus if you eat the wrong thing out there in the bush, you can die. You know, there's also medicines out there. You know, like my dog, sometimes every blue moon or so, you know, you let her outside, then she'll be eating some grass. You know, just eating some grass, and then a few moments later or later in the day, she'll vomit that up. But she just knows that instinctively. But man, the typical man, particularly in Western countries, we do not know If you let us, you know what? If you release the typical Western man in the Amazon jungle with maybe a day's ration of food, and that's it, you know, you got to learn how to, you got to feed yourself in the Amazon jungle, the typical man would probably die within a matter of weeks. Because we simply have, we, for the most part, not all of us, but for the most part, modern man does not, we're not in tune to the lavish abundance of water. And for, like I say, every, show me a forest, or show me the woods, and I'll show you nature's grocery store. So, I'm trying to think of what the man was literate. And he learned all that. He learned how to build a house. You know, he learned how to secure land. I mean, 200 acres, man. Come on. I don't know if he knew about anything about, you know, making his own clothes or whatever. Look at what all he accomplished without knowing how to read. Harriet Tubman. Look what she did. Not knowing how to read. Yet today, we can read. We got an internet connection. We got all kind of electronics. But what do you call that, Robin? I don't know. It looks like we're...
Progress, modern technology. It's pretty phenomenal, really, when you think about it all.
I personally think that this is why I'm a big proponent of homeschooling. Now, I'm not... All right, reading is good, okay? I'm not knocking reading. But I think education, real education, I think was better back during these times when these people were born into slavery. Because first thing, there was no Walmart, Kmart, Sears, none of that. So a lot of people back then had to learn how to sew. And they weren't sewing on modern sewing machines as we know them today. Food. You know, there was no Whole Foods or Wegmans or Piggly Wigglies or whatever grocery stores like. I mean, they had some grocery stores, but not as we like we know them today. So they had to learn how to grow food. In my opinion, unless you get into things like rocket scientists or something like that, but for the fundamental basics of life, food, clothing, and shelter, and I'm going to go one more, natural medicine, food, clothing, shelter, and natural medicine, I would say the average slave that walked the earth during the slave period was more educated than the typical person that has graduated and will graduate from an Ivy League school. That's my belief. There's a book or a documentary titled Possum Living. I think I've covered that on here before. And by, I think she's still living. The author's name, which is her pen name, is Dolly Freed. And Dolly Freed was homeschooled. Later on, she did become some type of an engineer and work for NASA or something like that. But all right, we're going to go to another phone call here in a couple of minutes.
Welcome to Camp Hugue. Hugue.
This 11-year-old spent her summer turning the inside of this camper from this to this.
I was looking through an American Girl magazine, and I saw a camper for $650 for an American Girl, and it was a very nice camper. My dad said that was really expensive for us, so he said that we could get a real camper for that amount of money. So then I went out and I started looking for one. We saw down the road a house had a camper for sale that I had been looking at for a while. So I really wanted to get it, and the guy said it was for $500. And then I told him $400 because that was what I had, and he said sold.
And the total cost of renovations thus far? $400.
We had looked on Pinterest and saw a lot of cool camper ideas, and I liked this beachy boho style with lots of plants and different colors and sea glass and driftwood, that style. So I liked that, and we decided to paint the camper walls white and then our kitchen cabinet turquoise. So this is my dining area. I got this from our potting shed that had dust and dead flies all over it, so we cleaned it up and that's what we got. We planted some plants from Dollar General in there. We have all of this on the backside came from our house except for that one picture back there from Dollar General. And a fun fact about these, this table and these cabinets, they flip down into a bed and so does this. And then over here we have the kitchen where we can't quite cook stuff yet, but it's very decorative. And this is our refrigerator to fit inside of it. And then if we walk a little further down, we have right here, these are very nice decals that we got for a dollar at the Dollar Tree. And then if we walk a little bit farther in here, we have a mirror that we painted the edges that came with the camper originally. And we have a closet over here, and it says Lauren's Little Camper. I got this sign from my neighbor who made it for me. And then we keep walking, and now we're in the bedroom. So we have four beds in here, and we got these really cute mattresses off of Etsy.
She painted most of it herself. She had her grandma come over the one day and help with the cupboards, but I would be gone for the day, and I'd come home, and she'd say, like, you could tell, and I'd say, how long were you in here? And she's like, oh, I painted about 4 hours straight.
Well, I'm very creative and artistic, so I love to paint and draw and stuff like that, so it kind of came to me naturally.
With this COVID thing, it's kind of interrupting her fun that she wants to have in it, but she's making the best of it.
Lauren hopes to be able to have friends over soon, but a chance to get away from home works for now.
I hope you enjoyed my camper tour. Thanks for stopping by.
This is Inside Edition Digital.
All right, that's Laura Nelson, who's 12 years old right now. I would say she's literate. Let me, I have to go to the dictionary on this one. And one day we might have a two-hour powwow on literacy and education. All right, according to, now I'm in, this is the, I guess, the Merriam-Webster dictionary. The definition of literate, now this is not LA's words, I'm just reading. The definition of literate is someone who can read and write or someone who is educated in a specific area of knowledge. A person who is well-educated is an example of someone who will be described as literate. All right, In modern times, now I'm going to give my commentary. Let me go back to this definition again. The definition of literate is someone who can read and write, or someone who was educated in a specific area of knowledge. I'm going to dissect this and give you my version using the exact same words. The definition of literate is someone who is educated in a specific area of knowledge. Josiah Henson, although he couldn't read or write, he was literate at navigating the Underground Railroad, which he had to be proficient at astronomy, you know, how to read the stars at night, you know, where he was going, north, south, east, and west. Hell, even in the morning, the sun, how can you tell east from west? First thing in the morning. Okay. Just knowing, being observant of what position is the sun when it rises early in the morning, you know, and checking it out during the day, where does it sit at night? That's a form of literacy that some people don't know. As simple as that is, at least I think it's simple. Okay. He knew how to forage his food. You know, I'm not there. I'm here in Florida, so, you know, if I get in a citrus orchard, I can navigate that. Okay. But if you put me in the Glades, and I had to feed myself basically on the Glades, you know, I don't know how to forage the food down there. There's plenty of it. And then if I'm down there and I get too weak because I don't know how to forage for, you know, the natural vegetation that's there in abundance in the Glades, they have alligators there that are dramatically stronger than me, even when I'm at full strength, and they'll eat me. So this man had a lot of literacy. Here in 2022, now my take, and I had to bring Warren Houston in on this one day, I think one of the reasons why black men keep on getting shot and killed, or in many cases it appears that they might be getting the shaft in the legal system, particularly when it comes to criminal justice, is because on a wholesale basis, now this is just LA's thinking, you can disagree with me, on a wholesale basis, the typical black American, particularly black male American, is not law literate. Warren Houston has a saying, if you don't know your rights, you don't have any. If you don't know your rights, and I agree with him, if you don't know your rights, you don't have any rights. You know, a lot of shootings. Now, I'm not talking about the bizarre shootings that happen to black people, but a lot of the shootings that happen between white police officers or any police officer and a black person or any person, a lot of times, if you look at the video objectively, not subjectively, a lot of us, for whatever reason, we don't know what the word compliance means. We don't know what it means. We don't know what it looks like. This is what I call law literacy, or in this case, law enforcement literacy. So there are a gazillion things to study on this planet. You know, you can be computer literate. And there's so many different ways to look at, you know, computers are just not one monolithic thing. It's got many facets to computer science. You know, how literate are you? So Josiah Henson, a lot of these people that were legally born slaves, because obviously Josiah Henson, he was literate enough not to get caught, number one. I'm sure there's plenty of people that sat on that Underground Railroad that because they were Underground Railroad illiterate. Josiah Henson and Harriet Tubman and others made several trips and never got caught. They were Underground Railroad literate. They knew directions. They knew paths. They knew how to avoid danger spots. They knew how to eat. Because once again, there was no 7-Eleven, no rest stops, nothing like that as we know them here in 2022. So Harriet Tubman couldn't read. But she was able to buy land. She was able to have a boarding house. She was a businesswoman. That's one of the hats that she wore. So these were, in my opinion, very literate people. Whereas you have some people that are, man, they're Rhodes Scholars. But they have no sense of direction unless they have a smartphone or some type of electronics with a GPS on it. Anyway, once again, what makes you literate? The definition of literate, I'm reading it again, is someone who can read or write or to me is the operative word. Someone who is educated in a specific area of knowledge. I think that's really the best definition. Someone who is educated in a specific area or areas of knowledge. And I think just me thinking it's they put too much emphasis on reading and writing. Let's see. What makes a person socially literate? All right, by saying someone is illiterate socially, it promotes an assumption that they have absolutely no skills. You know what? A lot of people who are in the social services office that go to the social service office, not all, but a good many of them, once again, in my opinion, that's why they have a social worker. They're socially bankrupt. They don't have the proper people skills to get what they want. Many people that go to the social services, many, not all, particularly the youngins, who have parents that are living, but they haven't picked up, they're not socially literate on how to maintain social relationships with parents, with children, with coworkers, with friends. And money, legal tender, EBT cards, WIC, I think they all contribute to a person because a lot of people say, well, you know, if I got these financial resources, I really don't need to deal with another person. In any event, going back to C.R. Patterson and Sons, they jumped out there, and we got to get them on here. Ed Mims, with Mims Auto, I believe, they have, I don't know if they've released it yet, but I think they got a website, Mims Auto. Let me look it up real quick before I go to this next call. Let's see. Mims Auto. Let me look. Mims EV. I think it's on M's Motor. M's Motors, I think that might be it. Hold on. Navigating here. M's Motors.
Welcome to Camp Huguet. Huguet.
This 11-year-old spent her summer turning the inside of this camper from this to this.
I was looking through an American Girl magazine, and I saw a camper for $650 for an American Girl, and it was a very nice camper. My dad said that was really expensive for us, so he said that we could get a real camper for that amount of money. So then I went out and I started looking for one. We saw down the road a house had a camper for sale that I had been looking at for a while. So I really wanted to get it, and the guy said it was for $500. And then I told him $400 because that was what I had. And he said sold.
And the total cost of renovations thus far? $400.
We had looked on Pinterest and saw a lot of cool camper ideas, and I liked this beachy boho style with lots of plants and different colors and sea glass and driftwood, that style. So I liked that, and we decided to paint the camper walls white and then our kitchen cabinet turquoise. So this is my dining area. I got this from our potting shed that had dust and dead flies all over it, so we cleaned it up and that's what we got. We planted some plants from Dollar General in there. We have all of this on the backside came from our house except for that one picture back there from Dollar General. And a fun fact about these, this table and these cabinets, they flip down into a bed, and so does this. And then over here we have the kitchen where we can't quite cook stuff yet, but it's very decorative. And this is our refrigerator to fit inside of it. And then if we walk a little further down, we have right here, these are very nice decals that we got for a dollar at the Dollar Tree. And then if we walk a little bit farther in here, we have a mirror that we painted the edges that came with the camper originally. And we have a closet over here, and it's the Lawrence little camper. I got this side from my neighbor who made it for me. And then we keep walking, and now we're in the bedroom. So we have four beds in here, and we got these really cute mattresses off of Etsy.
She painted most of it herself. She had her grandma come over the one day and help with the cupboards, but I would be gone for the day, and I'd come home, and she'd say, like, you could tell, and I'd say, how long were you in here? And she's like, I painted about 4 hours straight.
Well, I'm very creative and artistic, so I love to paint and draw and stuff like that, so it kind of came to me naturally.
With this COVID thing, it's kind of interrupting her fun that she wants to have in it, but she's making the best of it.
Lauren hopes to be able to have friends over soon, but a chance to get away from home works for now.
I hope you enjoyed my camper tour. Thanks for stopping by.
This is Inside Edition Digital.
Did you ever see a hangman tie a hangknot? Did you ever see a hangman tie a hangknot? I've seen it many a time, and he whines after 13 times he's got a hangknot. Tell me, will that hangknot slip? No, it will not.
Welcome to Camp Huguet. Huguet.
This 11-year-old spent her summer turning the inside of this camper from this to this.
I was looking through an American Girl magazine, and I saw a camper for $650 for an American Girl, and it was a very nice camper. My dad said that was really expensive for us, so he said that we could get a real camper for that amount of money. So then I went out and I started looking for one. We saw down the road a house had a camper for sale that I had been looking at for a while. So I really wanted to get it, and the guy said it was for $500. And then I told him $400 because that was what I had, and he said sold.
And the total cost of renovations thus far? $400.
We had looked on Pinterest and saw a lot of cool camper ideas, and I liked this beachy boho style with lots of plants and different colors and sea glass and driftwood, that style. So I liked that, and we decided to paint the camper walls white and then our kitchen cabinet turquoise. So this is my dining area. I got this from our potting shed that had dust and dead flies all over it, so we cleaned it up and that's what we got. We planted some plants from Dollar General in there. We have all of this on the back side came from our house except for that one picture back there from Dollar General. And a fun fact about these, this table and these cabinets, they flip down into a bed, and so does this. And then over here we have the kitchen, where we can't quite cook stuff yet, but it's very decorative. And this is our refrigerator, to fit inside of it. And then if we walk a little further down, we have right here, these are very nice decals that we got for a dollar at the Dollar Tree. And then if we walk a little bit farther in here, we have a mirror that we painted the edges that came with the camper originally. And we have a closet over here, and it says Lauren's Little Camper. I got this side from my neighbor who made it for me. And then we keep walking, and now we're in the bedroom. So we have four beds in here, and we got these really cute mattresses off of Etsy.
She painted most of it herself. She had her grandma come over the one day and help with the cupboards, but I would be gone for the day, and I'd come home, and she'd say, like, you could tell, and I'd say, how long were you in here? And she's like, oh, I painted about 4 hours straight.
Well, I'm very creative and artistic, so I love to paint and draw and stuff like that, so it kind of came to me naturally.
With this COVID thing, it's kind of interrupting her fun that she wants to have in it, but she's making the best of it.
Lauren hopes to be able to have friends over soon, but a chance to get away from home works for now.
I hope you enjoyed my camper tour. Thanks for stopping by.
This is Inside Edition Digital.
What's up, everybody? This is Jay, and this video is about, is Tariq worth $2 million? Now, we all know that he's a damn fool, and he deserves what he's getting, but is he worth $2 million? Before we do, let's hit that like button. I need to get 200 likes for this video, and if you haven't already, please subscribe and bang that bell. I'm trying to reach 20,000 subs by the end of the month. Let's get into it. Now, Tariq, we all know, is a damn fool. He doesn't listen to Ghost or Tasha, and he's been corrupted by Kanan and turned against his father by Kanan and Tasha, and now he thinks that he's a dope boy when all he is a dorm room dope boy. He doesn't know anything about real life situations, and so he tried to get over on Vincent and the Olive Garden dope boy crew, and he bought some baby aspirin and tried to pass it off as being some pills, ecstasy, or whatever the case. And no, that would not work. If anything, he would have been better off trying to cut it. But he's an idiot. He knows nothing about this. He thought because they look similar that Vincent wouldn't know anything. And yeah, maybe with the eye test he wouldn't know, but once they began to sell the merch, then people would complain saying that these were duds, that the strength was weak, it was nothing, and that ruined his business. not necessarily put him out of business, but made him look bad as if he was selling duds to people trying to take their money. And Tariq already got his face smashed in the ground like a puppy that pooped on the carpet in their living room. And so that wasn't enough for him to realize that these are not the people that he should be messing with. And he came back talking about he was a man of his word. And then he sold them a bag of bull crap, whereas he would have been better off telling them, hey, I don't have the weight. I wish I had it, whatever the case, but, you know, I'm not able to do it. I'm out. But instead, he's trying to get money and sell stuff. That's not it. And even Vincent pulled out a gun in front of his face and let him know, hey, don't mess with me. And even that wasn't a good enough warning for Tariq not to do it. He's such an idiot. And so now he's in big trouble, and they want $2 million or else they were gonna kill him. And my cousin Vinny, he don't give a rat's ass or a witch's titty how Ghost and Tommy come up with the money. And Tariq, he's such an idiot, he doesn't know that now what he's done has allowed Vincent to put the squeeze like toothpaste on Ghost, Tommy, and Tasha to come up with money to save his life once again. He almost had that happen when he was with Kanan and they was going to kidnap him. And then he had Proctor killed and put Proctor's daughter in a situation where she has no parents. And he think because he took her to cousin Benny's house that he did good. He had his whole apartment where he lived ruined thanks to what he did working with Tommy. He doesn't have any idea on how to think first before he causes actions, because if he did, he wouldn't have went on ahead and tried to pull that move with my cousin Vinny. And now he's sitting there looking stupid, but about to end up biting the bullet because he ended up trying to play and get over the wrong dude. These aren't the dorm room kids that you've been serving. And now the only good thing is that Tommy and Ghost are working together. Maybe they may be able to reconcile, but everybody got to keep in mind Ghost doesn't know Tommy is the one that killed Proctor and shot up his apartment. And Tariq is just sitting there looking stupid while all of this was going down with his lips poked out like he got a trout mouth or something. And he doesn't realize the magnitude of trouble he's in. Now, we know that Vincent really only wanted to keep Tariq because he knew that he could have leverage on Ghost and Tommy. And I think since every episode there's been somebody that died, I believe Vincent is going to die in episode 6. And so that'll be the end of my cousin Vinny. And if he does survive, he's definitely going down in episode 7. But Ghost, he's not going to forget this. He's not going to let this go, that this dude is extorting him. And now in order to come up with $2 million, Ghost is almost broke by between paying Jason and all the different things that he's had to do and the QCP project and things. He's almost broke. Tommy doesn't manage his money right, and he got to pay for the re-up and things, but I'm sure he probably has more money than Ghost right now. And so now Ghost is forced back into the game that he's been trying to get out since the very first episode, thanks to Tariq. And Tasha, it's just going to be a mess because she's got these other dudes that she's working with. My cousin Vinny, he's going to be looking forward to, he thinks he has the upper hand, not realizing once they pay the money and then they get Tariq back, he's screwed. Ghost and Tommy is going to get him for that. They might even get their money back. I don't know how they're going to make $2 million in 24 hours. Even if they get more weight, they're going to have to try to move all that weight in the same day. And that just because you have it doesn't mean all your connects and premieres want to buy that much right now. And so it's going to be one hell of an episode, episode 6, to see how this is going to happen. And even counting up $2 million takes a little bit of time in cash. That's going to take a few hours, even with the counting machines. They're going to have a couple people just doing that. And so Dos and Tommy, like he told them, we ain't boys, we ain't cool, but we brothers. And they both got the common interest, which is love for Tariq, even though that boy is an idiot. He keeps calling James Ghost to his face, and then anytime he wants to get hard, he telling him, get the fork off of me, and he's all in his face with his lips poked out when this dude can't do nothing right. The only person he's ever acted tough in front of is Ghost or the white kids he goes to school with, and they ain't gonna do nothing because he black, so they automatically are scared. Just like a Chinese dude, you automatically think he know karate, which we all know that's not true either. And so now we see in the previews for episode 6, Tariq is scared. He's shaking like a salt shaker. He got his mouth wide open, lips hanging on the floor. They got a gun pointed near him or at his head. And it looks like either they come close to not being able to pay on time, or they was just messing with him, trying to teach him a lesson not to do nothing stupid like that again. And it's probably in his best interest to get out the game, because he doesn't know what he's doing, and he doesn't listen when people try to tell him what's going on. He's sitting there looking stupid. He gonna need to change his baby diapers, because his little wee wee probably wet itself after this situation. I hope it did. And what do you all think? You all think Tariq is worth $2 million? If it was your son and he was acting the way he was, would you want to pay $2 million? We all got love for our kids, and yeah, they make mistakes, and in the end of the day, Tariq is young. If it was me, I would not want my son to die, but $2 million, considering how he acts, oh my goodness, this would be just a hard situation. Now, if I had millions on deck, that's different. I might have paid. But if I don't have the money and I'm trying to figure it out and do what I need to do, chances are I would still do it, because I would love my son. But once he got there, you talk about catching the smackdown, this dude would be getting the brakes beat off of him, and he would be on house arrest. So I don't know. We'll see. I'm going to put it up here. Y'all vote right here above. Would you save your son? Would love come out stronger than money? Or would you say, forget it, this dude is ruined, he doesn't get it, and he's going to have to pay for his actions? I'm interested to see what you guys vote. Also, out my website, I got it updated weekly with new information, new videos. Also, if you're interested in doing a collab.
Okay, I got a pleasant surprise a few minutes ago, so took care of that. And then I had a sort of a freak fall this past weekend, and I can't sit too long in any position, and I don't like taking painkillers. I'm all right and everything physically. It's just you know, it's what happened is I was I should have had the lights on where I was at, and I tripped on a piece of wiring that was on the floor. Shouldn't have had it there. But so in order to break my fall, I figure, you know, that I'll just reach out for the wall, and my depth perception was off, so the wall was further away than I thought it was, and I fell on a set of barbells I have, and I guess I fell right, because nothing was broken or nothing like that, no broken bones or crack, nothing, or just, you know, I can walk normal. When I'm standing up walking, you know, but I just can't sit in any one position for a long amount of time. So I've been doing, like if I take a plane, and I do not like to take pills, but in this case, what I did was, what's this? Advil. I'll break one. I'll take, now the directions say you can take, how many of it says you can take? At night before bedtime, do not take more than 2 caplets in a 24-hour period of time. So I took one pill and broke it into 2. A half dose. And just that the slight pain I do have goes away. And it's not a throbbing pain, but it's, like I say, when I'm standing up, you don't even feel it. When I sit down, you feel a little bit of discomfort. But I fell on two barbells. So I've taken 2 of those in the, within the last, 16 to 20 hours. They say you're not supposed to take more than 1 or 2 a day. So what I'll do, like right after this podcast, I'll get a hot water bottle and place it on that sore area. And typically I feel good in a matter of minutes when I do that. So I'd rather do that than do the pills. But in any event, but I had a pleasant surprise at the door. So I had to go take care of that. And that's why I was playing in that non-related thing. But today we talked about C.R. Patterson and Sons. The older Patterson started out as legally as a slave, learned the carriage business, then eventually the horseless carriage business, as we know them today, automobiles. They had their own little manufacturing concern there for a while, and just didn't have enough money to sustain it and keep on growing or whatever. So, but you do have MEMS Motors, and they're into EVs, electric vehicles. 314 area code, your mic is open.
What do you say, L.A.?
How's it going? Good Monday morning. Good afternoon here, Monday where you. I mean, morning still where you are, though.
Where's Robin at?
Her mic is open. Robin, you there? She was on earlier. And her mic is still open.
Robin made some good point.
She's somewhere around here. She's on West Coast.
You know, I think that the only place you could probably find one of Patterson cars today is probably over in Cuba.
Now, would it be in a collector's, finding it within some auto collector or a museum?
No, because I went to a museum of transportation and right outside of St. Louis, and I asked the people if they ever heard of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they said no. But over in Cuba, you know, that population over there is known for having a lot of old cars that they continue to operate because of many of the sanctions that was imposed on the country, the island. So some of those people, you can see them driving around in 1952 Buicks. So if you're going to find one of his vehicles, of course, he started off with the horseless carriage.
Right.
He worked with a white blacksmith where he got them skills from in that operation. Did you read that?
I read the part where he went into business with a white guy.
Yeah, I don't know what he had on his own, but I think he worked with that white business person.
Yeah, that's where he worked with the white guy first. It's, where is it? The guy's name is, here it is, Ray Patterson. Charles Patterson partnered with a local carriage builder, J.P. Lowe, a white man, and they created J.P. Lowe and Company in 1873.
Yeah, 18. So I don't know what he was doing. Yeah. I don't know. So he probably took his money that he made while working and bought into the business.
Right, because eventually, according to Wikipedia, he later he bought the shares of Lowe, and that's how he, you know, it became what it, you know, that the family business.
Yeah, they were manufacturing. They was manufacturing horse drawn, and then he went into doing. He was like an assembler. Although he made the carriages, and they also had like a one of those vehicles that hauled milk, like a wagon. He got his engines from Germany. They was Continental engines that he used, that I read in his vehicles. That's the same thing.
That's a very good point
you
brought up. He was an assembler, because later on, he subcontracted out to another company to, you know, build the, I guess, the frame. And, you know, that's the right word, he assembled. That's what they mostly do at Detroit. Those guys are, correct me if I'm wrong, those are assembly companies, aren't they?
Yeah, they're not manufacturers, because they don't have...
Right.
You know, even in Africa, you got companies, European countries, that will send vehicles broken down into Africa today, and they assemble the parts, they assemble the vehicle. They don't have steel making plants, rolling mills to make sheet metal and so on and so on and so on. They're a long ways off from that.
Well, I guess a lot of people, I know I got confused at one time, because I was thinking that the big three in Detroit were manufacturers, but now I found out, I was told differently, they were assembly companies.
They had to source out the pieces that they wanted to make. Patterson had either a 12 or 13 spoke quill. Let's see, he needed a 12, 3, 6, 9. I think he had a 12-spoke wheel on his vehicles. And those were made someplace else. He didn't make those.
Well,
so that's the whole deal of when you talk about the automobile industry. It's got many sub-industries that provide parts.
Yeah, there's a lot of them. Tires, hubcaps.
And it wasn't no engine building going on. It wasn't no engine building going on in the United States at that time. The people who had the capabilities of doing that was in Germany. Not that I know of that was in the United States. Now, Ford came along. Ford was manufacturing his own engines. But in the pre-1900s, I don't think it was an engine building going on.
Well, now with the Model T, what, he really just assembled the Model T, right?
No, I think he made the engines too, because he went on to do a V8 engine also, which was much, much later. But he had the ability to machine, and I believe he had the ability to cast too. So you had to build it. You would have need to be able to smelt iron, bigots, and then be able to drill and machine the cylinders. And I think he started off with a 4-cylinder, so that was less complicated than a 8-cylinder, which is you have 4 cylinders on each side.
Okay.
Inline 4s and inline 6s is easy. But, you know, you talk about the slaves. You had, in 1860, about 3.8% of whites had slaves of the entire population, according to records that's kept. And
that's not a whole lot of
blacks.
People.
No. Then you had these black slave owners. Blacks played a big major part in the introduction of slaves in the United States, especially as agents and shippers,
mm-hmm.
especially down in New Orleans area, where you had a lot of that activity going on. You had some blacks back in them days that had 12,000-acre farms. That's a lot of acres.
That's a lot. That is. That's quite a bit of land.
Yeah, you had, and some of them was women. I think they talk about one, and she had like over 200 some odd slaves in a whole host of different, they were doing cotton, of course, and really cotton didn't hit the United States until in the late 1700s.
Mm-hmm.
According to some things I came across. But yeah, you had one woman, her family holding was over 12,000 acres.
Man, that's a lot of that's a lot of land.
Yeah, it is.
That's a lot of land.
Then it wasn't
enough
for
I wonder
to
how
have.
Many people she had, because you know, you need help to manage that big spread like that.
Well, some of them had like 4,000 acres, had about 120 slaves, so you would have to have close to 500 slaves.
Because what's his name? Joseph Jake Simmons Jr. I think his family had like a 1,000-acre ranch when he was coming
up. Jake Simmons was a Cherokee Indian. He wasn't on no black, native black American. People get that mistaken, too, because of skin color.
Right.
Now, Martin Delaney was doing some reporting on black businesses. And you got entrepreneurs and intrapreneurs. Entrepreneurs like a slave who had their own business. But Martin Delaney made lists
that's a term I haven't heard of before. Okay.
Of businesses that blacks had along the lines of pharmaceuticals. This is some of the ones I pulled out other than what you would call like people who was in the restaurant business and people who were doing clothiers and so forth. But yeah, steamboat owners in St. Louis. Sail manufacturers, railroad car owners, of course, wood factors, shipping, employment agency, building contractors, glaziers, concert band, lead on the concert band. It's entertaining.
You know what? There must be something going on in St. Louis because I'm just, just over the years, I'm from Prince, but the number of black entrepreneurs in St. Louis or in and around St. Louis.
Even Barry Meacham or Meacham Park there in Kirkwood. My wife's aunt lived there.
Mm-hmm.
He was a steamboat owner running up and down the Mississippi. And see, at that time, Kirkwood would have been wilderness. You had some business owners that built homes for their employees, and a lot of them were located out in Kirkwood.
Mm-hmm.
So Meacham Park is an area in Kirkwood that was like a black population. And that was where Cookie Thornton lived. Cookie Thornton was a black guy. Man, he was a business owner. He was sort of like an excavator.
Mm-hmm.
And the Kirkwood officials were doing him kind of bad. I remember one day he stopped over at my house and talked about it. But anyway, he went into a board meeting and killed about 5 or 7 people. And
that wasn't a good day, man.
And
not for them,
I know his name was Cookie, and I don't know when I put the Thornton onto it. I might be taking that name from somebody, but I think his entire name was Cookie Thornton. You could probably look him up on Wikipedia and talk, do a search on killing Kirkwood business officials by disgruntled businessmen. So Meacham was from Meacham, who had the school out in the middle of the Mississippi River. He was also a steamboat owner. Nobody talks about that. You know, one of the most disturbing things about these stories, the blacks who's always propagating,
what's that?
Reparation, and they mention these people's names. Well, they don't tell the entire story about these folks.
Or they don't know any of the story at all, and then you brought up a word today that's brand new to me, entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's my homework assignment between today and tomorrow.
Yeah,
but
and,
you're right. Most of them don't know the history.
Right. They talk about critical race stuff, and they leave out the critical information about the people that they be talking about, or critical information about the subject that they be talking about. And I think they do that to mislead folks.
Mm-hmm.
Because nobody talks about these black plantation owners, and it wasn't just a handful. These people was rich. Matter of fact, when Dunn and Bradstreet list them, Dunn and Bradstreet today, it wasn't no Bradstreet back then, they list them as being rich. And as a matter of fact, in the $200,000 to $400,000 range, even back then. So what would that equate to today's dollars?
You're right.
And these dates go back. I've seen dates on black businesses that go back to the 1600s. But they started doing some intensive information, like between the 1770s on through 1865. And Robin was talking about the slavery and the Ashantis. All them African groups had Ashantis. See, Africans got rid of those that they didn't want. That's another thing that black, that they don't consider. For whatever reason, they didn't want them. They got rid of them. Not in all cases. Of course, some was kidnapped, stole, and they wasn't kidnapped by whites because they wouldn't have no reason to. A merchant or a broker is going to set up a holding station on the shores. Because if you have a system where you have entities bringing those commodities to you, well, you don't want to have to travel no 100 miles to take them where you can ship them off, right?
Right.
Well, same thing with them bodies. They brought them to their holding points, and today you can see them. They call them slave castles. So they brought them to the whole slave castles, and the merchants, after they do the examination, they would buy them. In Ghana, they got one place there that they designate as the last bath. And what that means is that the slaves that was on those slave routes, and it was a whole bunch of them, it was all over, looked like roads on a map. They would come to one river. I don't forget the town, but that's where they used to have, they used to say that they took their last bath. So they bathed them down.
That boat.
Well, no, they came to the market. They down, eased them up, all the and so on. It's salt water concoction. They put the genital something going on there. Also in the butt. And was examined down at the market. They weren't presentable.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing you do when you want to sell, you clean it up. Windows, paint, so on and so on. Same thing, a used car. You vacuum the inside, wash it, wax it, black, put that stuff on the tires and make them shine. So that's the way they done commodities before they got rid of them.
Mm.
Yeah, went to a produce market to buy watermelon. They could usually have one melon split, a plug, so you can take a look at the inside of it.
I remember going to a, when I was younger, we went to a farmer's market in D.C., and my mother was buying a watermelon, so this guy took another watermelon right beside it and took a knife and carved it like a little triangle and pulled it out.
Yeah, the plug.
It was the color, it was the color that she liked, so we didn't buy that one, but we bought one that was sitting right next to it.
Yeah, when I was a kid, I learned another method to tell whether a melon is ripe or not. And I used the broom straw.
Well, that probably took up less space.
Now, you know, here's another thing. You talk about businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Black business today, of course, in any group of people, society, you're going to have those who can, those who can't. I'm sure you would agree upon that.
Yeah.
But when you look at the male and female business between the Hispanic, then the Latino, the white, black, Asian, Native Hawaiian, and American Indian, the black Hispanic, well, the highest, the black Asian woman's gross business is $216,579.95. Then after her comes the white female,
mm-hmm.
who is $192,784 a year. Then after her comes the Latino, which is $162,731. After Latino comes the Native Hawaiian, which is $77,405. After her come the American Indian, which is $71,456. And after her comes the Latino, Hispanic, Latino. The other one was not Hispanic, Latino. You got the Hispanic, Latino,
mm-hmm.
which is number six, which is $56,670. Then that comes next is the black female, which is $28,860. Look at the great difference between there. And even going back to the male business person of the group, the Asian, actually the white is the first with $850,347. Then you got the not Hispanic Latino male, $756,299. Then you got the Asian male, which is $530,000.
Okay.
$733,000. Then you got the Native Hawaiian, and the American Indian, both, who was about $235,000. The black male is $133,035 a year.
Hmm.
Now, the question is what kind of business are these people doing? And then there is where you would see why come there's a certain discrepancy when it comes down to income. Now, when you look at the Nigerians are clean off the chart. That's why come they need to be separated out of this category called black. I think which they even asking for. Don't you think? Because
yeah.
It's not showing a true representation of what they're doing as a ethnic group.
Hmm.
So what's going on there with these businesses? Because everyone would agree that when you start doing commercial business yourself, your income for yourself and your family goes up.
Right. Well, now, a lot of these, would you consider a sole proprietorship with no employees, other than maybe a receptionist for the phone, a business?
Well, any configuration that you have is included in this business survey, which is put on by U.S. Census. Blacks have more businesses than employees.
Right. It's
like 1.5 million businesses, less than a million employees, according to this report, which was done. They do them every 10 years, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So one would have to ask, what the heck's going on? Why come you're not? And folks say, well, we need to have our own business so we can hire our own. Well, that ain't happening. For whatever the reason.
Right. Well, I'm looking at I don't consider a sole proprietorship. You're self-employed. Like, let's say you got a one-man drywall business, and you're the drywaller. So if you
mm-hmm.
get sick for whatever reason, when you don't work, you know, the company doesn't work. Whereas if you have the person next to you, they have a drywall company, but they have people, or they subcontract out the work to others who actually do the work. And they have several jobs going on at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, people have their own definitions of whatever.
All right, well, Lily.
All right. I don't know what happened around
her life. Discussion on C.R. Patterson.
Tomorrow we're going to cover somebody that I think you're going to relate to, but I'll announce it then. All right, have a good day.
I'll talk to you later.
All right.